Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with James McMurdy, and we can't make it here anymore to introduce today's show. Dar Jamail joins us from New Orleans in Louisiana, where he's working as an independent journalist reporting on the situation in the Gulf. Before we turn to the ongoing catastrophe in the Gulf, news from Israel and Gaza. Israel's nuclear arsenal is one of the world's worst-kept secrets, and one that Israel insists on maintaining. The United States practices a policy of ambiguity with respect to this nuclear stockpile, neither publicly discussing it nor forcing the Israeli government to acknowledge its existence. But President Obama is emphasizing nuclear non-proliferation, and this further complicates what has been a rocky relationship between Netanyahu and Obama in the last year. Then, at a meeting to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in May, the United States yielded to demands by Arab nations that the final document urge Israel to sign the treaty. That one paragraph buried deep in the 40 pages of dry language committing 189 nations to a world free of nuclear weapons has become the latest source of friction between Israel and the United States. Prior to this review in May, at the 2005 review conference, the Bush administration refused to go along with any references to Israel, one of several reasons the meeting ended in acrimony without any statement. Meanwhile, the raft of new sanctions against Iran that President Obama signed into law last Thursday has reassured Israelis. The United States, recognizing that the non-proliferation treaty document would upset the Israelis, sought to distance itself even as it signed it. Meanwhile, Israel believed it had assurances from the Obama administration that it would reject efforts to include such a reference. An Israeli official said that Israel saw this as another sign of unreliability by its most important ally. Meanwhile, Israel allows some goods into Gaza. Mideast envoy Tony Blair said, quote, "These changes are significant and once implemented should have a dramatic influence on the daily lives of the people of Gaza and on the private sector. Thousands of items that have not been available through legitimate channels for the last 3 years should now enter as a matter of course," unquote. Well, that does sound good, doesn't it? But in reality, the prospects for rebuilding the damage from a punishing Israeli military offensive last year remain uncertain. Materials like steel and cement, which Israel says can be diverted for use by the territory's ruling Hamas militants, would be allowed to enter only for international aid projects, and Gazans will still remain largely confined to their tiny territory. Omar Shaban, a Gaza-based economist, estimated that Gaza needs 3 million tons of cement and 600,000 tons of steel just to rebuild the damage. Quote, "To do business, Gaza needs all crossings to be operating fully for two years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to make up for what happened in the past 3 years and to cater to natural growth." This is Shaban, Omar Shaban, a Gaza-based economist. The list of restricted or disallowed goods includes items that could be used to manufacture weapons and explosives, like certain fertilizers and ball bearings. Those will be barred except with specific permission. Construction materials are concrete, steel cables, and asphalt, which Israel fears could be used by Hamas to build tunnels and fortifications, will be permitted only in coordination with the rival Palestinian government in the West Bank and the United Nations and other international agencies overseeing construction projects. We will keep an eye on this and keep you updated. We pay about $3 for a gallon of gasoline at the service station, but the real price of gas is much higher and camouflaged by myriad direct and indirect costs associated with maintaining our oil economy. How much are you actually paying for gas? Let us take a closer look at the hidden bills footed by your taxes. The cost of securing our access to Middle East oil is estimated at $50 billion per year. The federal government subsidizes the oil industry with numerous tax breaks and government protection programs worth billions of dollars annually. These benefits are designed to ensure that domestic oil companies can compete with international producers and that gasoline remains cheap for American consumers. Our dependency on oil from countries that are either politically unstable or at odds with the United States subjects the American economy to occasional supply disruptions, price hikes, and loss of wealth, which, according to a study commissioned by the U.S. Department of Energy, have cost us more than $7 trillion present value dollars over the last 30 years. That is more than the cumulative cost of all the wars fought by the United States since the Revolutionary War. The transfer of wealth to oil-producing countries, $1.16 trillion over the past 30 years, significantly increased our trade deficit. The Department of Energy estimates that each $1 billion of trade deficit costs America 27,000 jobs. Oil imports account for almost one-third of the total United States deficit, and hence are the majoring contributor to unemployment. The cost of securing our access to Middle East oil, deploying U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, patrolling its water, and supplying military assistance to Middle East countries is estimated at $50 billion per year, which adds additional dimes to each gallon of gasoline we purchase. Today, we look at the true cost of oil and fossil fuels. We spent the first half of today's show with independent journalist Dar Jamail, who joins us from New Orleans, reporting on the social and environmental costs of the ongoing catastrophe in the Gulf. It's my great pleasure to welcome Dar Jamail to Raising Sand Radio. Dar, it's great to have you with us again.
Great to be with you again.
And this time you are in the Gulf, and we're going to talk about that today. You're down there doing on-the-spot reporting. Tell us what you're seeing down there, Dar.
I've been down here almost a week now, and so far I've gotten the chance to see a good bit of the oil's effects in the area south of New Orleans. I'm based out of New Orleans, and my first full day here, we went down to Grand Isle, which was one of the areas first and most heavily affected by the spill. It's one of the southernmost areas of the state, a couple of hour drive south of New Orleans. It's basically the tip of the Mississippi Delta down there in that area. Very heavily hit, a lot of anger amongst people down there. You go down there and there's signs everywhere that people have put up in front of closed businesses, closed restaurants, and places where they sell fish and crab and this sort of thing, saying, thanks BP. That kind of thing. So a lot of anger, along with a lot of just kind of a sour, down, kind of depressed mood that kind of pervades all over. People, I think, are really understanding and taking in what this means, that this is not just some accident that people are going to get over and it's going to get cleaned up and they're going to move on, like what happened with Katrina, but this is a permanent situation and it continues to get worse. So I've seen a lot of that mood, but also just yesterday, in fact, we went out on a boat out into one of the areas of the marsh that has been affected and saw oil going into the marsh and killing it, of course. And then later on in the same day, we took a plane ride back out over some of the area in the bays back around Grand Isle and north of there, very, very heavily affected. We saw massive amounts of oil sheen across some of the bays in the Grand Isle area, as well as huge amounts of marsh that are very devastated by the oil.
And Dar, is there a smell to the air, or is this something that you're not really noticing yet?
We haven't really smelled it yet in that capacity, because we really haven't been over an area yet that's been completely saturated in heavy crude. Those are the areas where people are complaining of upper respiratory problems, burning eyes, headaches, this kind of thing. Although, for example, one of the flight services that we were talking with before we came out here had said he was taking people out to the site where the Discovery rig exploded and went down, and basically is ground zero for the spill. It's where the most crude is coming straight up to the surface out there about 55 miles south of the coast. And he said that as he goes out there, if he flies down as low as about 1,000 feet, that you can't stay down there that long at that elevation over the heavily slicked areas, because you literally can't breathe.
Wow.
And that's at 1,000 feet above. So this this starts to give people an idea of how big this is and how intense people and communities are being affected. There are actually a lot of areas down in the Venice area, which is another area very far south, one of the southernmost areas in the state, again, where there is so much oil down in that area that's washed ashore, that there are people that are literally sending their wives and kids fishermen who are sending their wives and kids to different areas to live because people are getting sick down there.
Hmm. And are they getting any compensation for that at this point?
Not at this point yet, no. There's been a real struggle for people to try to access some of this $20 billion that BP has theoretically set aside to compensate people. There are some who are being compensated, but so far what I've run into is that most of the fishermen, of course, are being put out of work by this because you can't go out and fish when the areas where you fish are completely soiled in oil. So most of the out-of-work fishermen are then being hired on by BP to run their boats to go out and take boom, to put boom around the marsh to try to protect it, which, again, is as we've seen firsthand, is really an exercise in futility. Anyone who understands how the boom system works knows it's basically for PR purposes. It doesn't really work in stopping the oil. It's putting boom out in seas that once any chop in the water forms whatsoever, once there's any kind of a sea state, it simply washes the oil directly over the boom straight onto the marsh anyway. But nevertheless, out-of-work fishermen, most of them are taking the jobs with BP, who are basically hiring out their boats to send them out to put out oil boom.
Dar, as an independent journalist down there, is it easy for you to get around? How are the restrictions on journalists and media?
Well, it's been very intense media censorship. It's been rather shocking. In our first couple of days here, me and my partner, who's down here working with me as a photographer, we've been rather taken aback, and we've had to kind of get our heads around the fact that, oh, yes, this is still supposed to be in the United States, because the media censorship has been so intense. For example, we went down a few days ago to a birdwatching facility at Fort Jackson, south of New Orleans, that had media days. Already they had restricted their public access by only having a few media days where they would open up for a couple of hours and let folks come in and take photos. And they changed that from 3 days down to 2 days, unbeknownst to us, very recently. So when we went down there, they were actually closed. And we had to find that out by trying to enter the facility and being stopped by a mercenary, by someone working for a local security company called HUD that had been hired out by BP. And again, they simply wouldn't let us go access what is theoretically a public facility down in Plaquemines Parish. So that was rather disconcerting. And then we had another instance where we had an interview set up with a professor at Louisiana State's Health Science Center here in New Orleans, but they're now very strictly checking out what media outlets you're for, who is this journalist, and we had a media already set up with this individual who was very happy to talk with us, but then the meeting got canceled by the chancellor of LSU, and then upon further investigation, it turns out LSU's one of several universities who's received $25 million in funding to do research on the effects of the spill, but clearly that money has come with some stipulations. So we're running into this censorship, and then also I should add, in addition to what I just said, that as of July 1, the Coast Guard announced that anyone that tries to come within 60 feet of oil cleanup operations, people on beaches or where they're putting booms out in the water around the marsh, Any media journalist that comes within 60 feet of those operations could be slapped with a $40,000 fine and a Class D felony. Hmm. So that gives you an idea of how intense the media censorship around this has been. And I think one of the more disconcerting parts about that is that, you know, this is all being carried out by a foreign company that's basically telling the U.S. government what to do.
Hmm. I'm interested in how the local people, people that were fishermen a month ago or so, are now working on this cleanup. Are they also holding to this media ban, or are they willing to talk to the media on the side whenever they can?
Most of them are not willing to talk to the media, because one of the stipulations of their hiring is that they are then not allowed to talk to the media, And if they are caught talking to the media or quoted anywhere or their photo turns up anywhere, then they will immediately lose their job. And for a lot of these folks, you know, these are people who spend all their money up front getting ready for the shrimping and the crabbing and the fishing season, and then they basically have 2 or 3 months to go make most of the money that's going to carry them and their families through the year. Well, that's now been wiped out. They've put up tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars to get all their gear ready and get ready for the fishing season, and now all that's completely wiped out by the oil. So they have to go find a way to try to make money any way they can. So that's why most of them have taken on jobs with BP. These are angry, bitter people. They don't want to be working for the company that just destroyed their livelihood, but literally they have no other choice financially. So they've taken these jobs. So most of them are not willing to jeopardize this little bit of income by talking to the media. But we've been able to find access around that by finding a few folks. We found an individual the other day who took us out in his boat into the marsh. He's a crabber down south, but he just decided, look, I'm not going to work with BP. I'm not going to hire myself out to those guys. And he was finding ways to take journalists out, as well as doing a little bit of crabbing still on the side. And he was still managing to get by without working for them. But that's an exception rather than the rule.
We're talking with Dar Jamail, who is based in New Orleans and working along the coast, bringing news about the oil spill. Dar, what is actually being done for the cleanup itself? I mean, we see pictures now and again of people on the beach with plastic bags, but I'm sure that's not the only thing that's happening.
Well, we have to keep in mind the scope of this disaster, that, you know, this isn't a one-off deal like the Exxon Valdez where a finite amount of oil spilled and now people are going to just clean it up. And let's keep in mind, in the Exxon Valdez, of that 259,000 barrels of oil that was spilled out of that tanker in 1989 in Alaska, to date only 14% of that amount has been recovered. And we're looking at worse statistics now with this, with an amount of oil that, if independent scientists' estimates of the flow rate being around roughly 100,000 barrels a day from nearly the very beginning of this disaster is correct, we're looking at an Exxon Valdez spill being injected into the Gulf of Mexico every 2.5 days, and now we're well into we're 70 odd days now into this disaster. We're talking about massive, massive amounts of oil that is being into the Gulf as we speak. So then when we look at the fact, these so-called cleanup efforts, they're a bit of a joke. First of all, we're talking about a minuscule amount of the oil that they're actually touching. They're injecting dispersants into the oil that's gushing out of the hole down in the bottom of the Gulf at 5,000 feet. Mainly to keep it from getting up to the surface where it can be seen, because then BP will then be suffering even greater liabilities and lawsuits if there's that much more oil that reaches the surface. They've, for example, prevented skimmer boats from coming. They're trying to keep as many skimmer boats from the site as possible because they're worried that skimmer boats would be able to actually start having tabulations of how much oil is on the surface. This, of course, increases BP's liability if this occurs. They've done other things like hiding. They've been accused of hiding dead wildlife, whether it be turtles or pelicans, other types of birds, other types of marine life. They're hiding it because anytime a particular endangered species is found dead, then, of course, they can be held liable for that. So they're looking at it from a purely economic perspective. They're just finding whatever way they can to minimize the liability that they're going to incur from this major disaster. And that is their primary concern, as opposed to actually doing what needs to be done, spending the amount of money that needs to be spent to really have a real go at doing what has to happen to try to contain this thing and really try to clean up as much as possible. And let me add, these booms, we've gone out and seen these firsthand in the marsh as well as from the air yesterday. And these booms, putting booms around these little areas of marsh is a complete joke. More often than not, we see completely oil-soaked areas of marsh that are then encircled by boom. All of the sheen is then held inside the boom. It's almost as though they've put boom around areas of marsh that's already been hit. More often than not, that's what we found. We did not find one instance of clear marsh surrounded by boom that was actually keeping the oil from reaching the marsh. Every single area we saw where there was boom, there was already oil on the marsh. So let's be real clear. This is just for PR. It's not really an effort that's having any effect in stopping this. And I can't emphasize how big of a disaster this is, and the fact that this is not a finite situation. It's getting worse every second that we've been speaking. And right now, there's really no end in sight.
And there's been some suggestions by scientists that have worked on these kinds of things in the past, that what's happening is as the oil is coming through the water, it's actually layering, and not all of it is coming to the surface at this point, that that's going to happen over time.
That's correct. In fact, most of it is not coming to the surface. That's why we've heard early on of these massive underwater plumes of oil, some of them 10 miles long, half a mile to a mile thick, and several thousand feet deep, these basically giant icebergs of oil floating around where you might see some on the surface, but the vast majority of it, 60, 80, 90% of it is actually under the water, and the brunt of that is because of this dispersant that is being used, where BP, it's been pretty effective at keeping it from all getting up to the surface, and that's why some of the surface oil appears in these giant red streaks. Clearly, that's not what crude oil should be looking like, but that's what it looks like when it's been hit with dispersant down at the source, and then when it does come up to the top, they are flying Hercules military planes over it, dispersing the dispersant from the air as an aerosol onto the oil to try to break it up. So most of it is not making it up to the surface, and that it does make it to the surface, they're acting as quick as they can to try to hit it with dispersant so that it doesn't appear as a giant oil slick. Other things they're doing to try to control is they're doing these giant surface burns, as much as 10 of these a day. When the weather's calm enough for them to do it, they skim it up as much as they can, group up the oil, and then basically light it a fire. And they've been burning thousands of barrels of this surface oil in this way. So then, of course, we look at what does this do to the atmosphere. Everyone knows what a tire looks like when it's lit on fire. Well, imagine that 1,000 times over in one of these burns where, thousands of barrels of black crude oil being burnt on the surface, and that's being injected straight into the atmosphere. And we've already had reports just in the last couple of days, actually, of people living down on the south coast of Louisiana having some health problems and respiratory problems because of this.
And when you say they, you're talking about BP is now doing these burns, or is it happening under someone else's control?
BP is running everything. Let's be real clear about that. As far as the media censorship, as far as the so-called cleanup operations, you'll hear about the Coast Guard being involved in some of these operations, but they all answer to BP. BP controls who goes out there. They control the type of operations they're being run, and then they're doing their best to control all of the media coverage of this situation. So, that's why let's be real clear about who's in charge. When, for example, it came to light earlier on in this disaster that this Corexit dispersant that BP is using is actually four times more toxic than the oil itself, and it's a dispersant that BP is actually not even allowed to use over in Britain, because they understand how toxic this is and they won't allow it to be used over there. And when this came to light, and then the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States of America ordered BP to stop using it, and BP simply refused, and they're using it to this day. So let's be very clear who's in charge here.
I want to talk a little bit about Biden's visit, but before we do that, you were there during the storm, this recent storm, Alex, that passed through?
That's correct.
What effect did that have?
Well, that two main things. Alex, even though it hit so far away, it was such a big storm that when these hurricanes hit down in the Gulf, and I spent a lot of my childhood down in Galveston, and I've seen this firsthand, where even though they'll hit hundreds and hundreds of miles away, you'll still see a pretty big increase in your tide as a result of the hurricane. So we still had 3 to 4 foot higher tides here in Louisiana, even though Alex hit so far away over in Mexico on the other side of the Gulf. And so what I saw that do, as was told by the fellow who took us down to the out in his boat to see the marsh yesterday, is he said, look, I was out here a week ago, and we had a whole lot more oil floating around. And now, in the wake of Alex after these tides, what happened is those tides basically just pushed the oil further up into the marsh. Hmm. And so it's had a very detrimental effect that way. The other effect that Alex had was that it shut down these skimming operations and what operations they do have going on out there at the source out in the Gulf where the rig used to be. It basically shut all that down because they had 12-foot high seas for a couple of days, and they're only just now starting to get some of those operations going back out there at the source.
Hmm. Dar, let's talk a little bit about Biden's visit and also Governor Jindal. Do they actually have press conferences? How are they handling the issue when they're down there?
Oh, they have press conferences all the time, but, you know, it's really clear that, you know, most people, of course, when Biden came, most people in Louisiana were very upset. I mean, there were, you know, I basically heard expletives every time his name came up, and particularly that we were frustrated the day he was here because we were going to go flying that day as well. But thanks to him coming to New Orleans, it shut down most of the airspace, and so we weren't able to go fly where we wanted to fly. So the local pilots down in Houma, south of here, weren't very happy about that either. But really, even more so, Jindal. I mean, this is a governor who, when the Obama administration first came out with their idea of a moratorium on drilling until they could get some better regulations and safety regs enforced, Jindal was the first one on the scene begging Obama, urging him strongly not to have a moratorium because some of the rigs that would be affected were those that were going to be right off the coast of Louisiana. This is a state whose economy is pretty heavily dependent on the oil industry, particularly the offshore drilling part of that. And so this is a guy who is basically, you know, no shocker here, he's basically in the back pocket of big oil and is an apologist for them. And his concerns are the economic benefits of that far more, those are his concerns far more so than the well-being of the people of Louisiana, the fishing industry, and certainly the environmental cost of this disaster.
Talk a little about Biden's visit.
Well, Biden basically shows up in New Orleans, and he goes into a place, a command and control center, supposedly a joint operation of the states and the feds and BP, walks around in this area. They call it the bullpen, the nerve center of the control area here. It's located in a big office building in downtown New Orleans. And he basically flew in, walked around the center, talked to a bunch of feds and Coast Guard folks. Jindal was with him, as well as one of the heads of BP America walking around with him. And he was very, very impressed, as he told reporters there, by what he saw. And he made a rather preposterous claim, the gist of which was something to the effect that, you know, the American people really have no idea how much is being thrown at this cleanup operation. And that was a comment that actually upset a lot of people in Louisiana. Anyone who read that in the Times-Picayune story on it, the local paper here in New Orleans, it's done a quite good job daily of covering this disaster. Anyone who read that comment of his was rather upset, because when you're here in New Orleans and south of here and really going to these places and seeing what is being done and the devastation wrought by this, you know, it's to hear the vice president say something like, well, people really have no idea how much is really being thrown at this. It's insulting. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, everyone here is very clear, you know, it's a bit of a joke when you look at what's being done to try to stop this and the so-called cleanup operations, as well as there's basically no real federal government pressure on BP to get these fundings out immediately to the people most affected. We're just not seeing it happen on the ground.
We're talking with Dar Jamail, who is, as I say, in New Orleans. I want to be sure that, Dar, you give people contact info where they can go and keep updated with your writing. But before we do that, what has been the most surprising and or shocking thing that you found down there?
Well, it's just seeing it firsthand. I was reading articles about this voraciously long before I got down here. Articles about how the booming operations are really just a joke and they're just for PR. The dead wildlife, how people's lives are really being altered forever. That people whose lives are based on the fishing industry and they've been doing this for generations down on the south coast of Louisiana, their lives are basically wiped out. And they have no idea what they're going to do. And it's one thing to read all this, but then to come down here and see it and see the joke that these booming operations are and see right there the oil going basically straight through the boom systems that they set up and just destroying the marsh anyway, and knowing that more is coming, much, much more, and seeing all of this firsthand and seeing these people who they understand that their lives are destroyed, and yet they want to bring you out to show you this catastrophe firsthand, and they're happy that they're there and they're treating you well. It's shocking. I mean, it's really been kind of a re-experiencing for me of some of what I saw over in Iraq, where some of the people, the hardest people affected by the catastrophe are the ones that are most open and most generous, and they're the warmest to you. And they're just grateful that you're there trying to tell the story. And it's really amazing to have experienced that in Iraq with the Iraqi people, and then now here with U.S. citizens suffering a different kind of catastrophe, but also not so indirectly, still at the hands of their own government.
Dar, what do you think about the future of oil or fossil fuel energy and alternative energy? Where do we appear to be heading when you look around you?
I hate to say it, but from what I see here, you know, if this is the biggest environmental disaster in this country's history, and if this isn't a wake-up call to get people out on the streets demanding that we get off oil and we get far more into alternative renewable energies and have a wartime response to make that happen, I don't know what else it's going to take. I mean, if we're looking at potentially, according to what some scientists are already reporting, a total annihilation of life in the Gulf of Mexico. And that means all natural life, animal life, marine life, but also all the populations that live around the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. There's a very, very, very real possibility they will not ever be able to stop this thing. We could have oil gushing out of the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico for years, if not decades. And if this is not enough to wake people up to their drastic need to get off of oil and use other alternative energy sources, I don't really know what is, but unfortunately, we're still not seeing that happen. We're still seeing, even in a lot of the left media, people treating this like it's some finite situation. It's just going to go away someday, and it's not going to. And in addition to this, we see wells right now that are drilling in even deeper water than this one was. So we're bound to repeat this catastrophe. So I'm down here in New Orleans wondering how much more is it going to take for people to basically force the government to do the right thing in this instance.
I'm actually going to spend the rest of this hour talking about oil. We talked last week about Australia. In fact, in some cases, these kinds of events are fairly commonplace, unfortunately. In Niger, in Australia, there was a burn that went on for 10 weeks in that country in 2008. And it's something that we're not really aware of enough in this country, I believe, in the United States. So this may make the difference in how people actually start to look at the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry.
Well, you know, it usually does take some kind of big catastrophe to shock people into awareness and action. And hopefully this will eventually have that effect, because it's so big, and I think over time people will continue to see, like it or not, how big this really is, and hopefully it will have some positive change come out of it.
Dar, how can people stay in touch with your writing while you're down there?
Well, I'm still maintaining my same website, so if folks simply go to dar.org, dahr.org, I'll be posting all my blog entries and hard news stories there.
Okay, and you'll also be putting up photographs, I understand.
That's correct. We will be posting photos there, and there'll even be more posted on my partner's website, and I'll certainly be linking to that as well.
Thank you so much for being with us, and stay in touch. You know, you are welcome to call me up anytime, and we can talk further about this event as things unfold.
Sounds great, Susan. Will do, because I'll be here for at least a few more weeks.
That is Dar Jamail. There's a link on Raising Sand Radio to Dar Jamail's site with his regular reports and updates, as well as photographs by Erica Blumfeld. You're listening to Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore. We air shows like this one each week, as well as archive all our shows for anyone to download. We're pleased to have listeners all over the world, from the United States to Australia, South Africa to Norway, and Lithuania to Turkey. We upload our shows in two file formats, one for broadcast and one for local listening. So go to the website again, Raising Sand Radio, and find the show that has the format that you want. Again, our website is raisingsandradio.org, and we're a project of MotherSpeak, which is motherspeak.org, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Go to the website raisingsandradio.org to find our range of progressive topics and download any shows for free. You can also purchase a CD of any shows too. And please assist our work of getting the word out by making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio or motherspeak.org, and we have links on both of those sites for you to make that donation, and it's sorely needed. MotherSpeak also begins a project we call This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. We examine Indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the U.S., Palestine, and South Africa, and we use the lens of industrialization to focus on what is happening to these people and environments, and we ask what can be learned from them that can inform more sustainable ways of living and making a living. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the projects too. Visit the website motherspeak.org to learn more about how you can contribute your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us. If you have stories about how your land in the area that you have grown up in, or land that has significance to you, you're also encouraged to share your stories with us. And again, go to motherspeak.org to learn more about that. Or you can also contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org if you want to contribute your own story. As we have heard, BP is conducting control burns that involve using shrimp boats to corral the oil by dragging together fire-resistant booms and then lighting the enclosed burn box on fire. The burn boxes are approximately 60 to 100 feet in diameter. Endangered sea turtles, including Kemp's Ridleys, that inhabit the Gulf of Mexico are also being caught in these burn boxes. This turtle burning was exposed by shrimp boat captain Michael Ellis recently. As of July 1st, 594 stranded sea turtles have been collected. Of those, 441 were dead when they were found, and a little over 150 were still alive. Many more have likely been killed or injured, but not found. An agreement reached just before the July 4th weekend among conservation groups, BP, and the Coast Guard will ensure measures to rescue sea turtles from the surface before setting fire to oil slicks. The agreement came as a result of a lawsuit filed on behalf of the Center for Biological Diversity, the Turtle Island Restoration Network, Animal Welfare Institute, and the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Miyoko Sakishita, Oceans Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, said, quote, "Endangered sea turtles need all hands on deck to work towards saving them from this terrible oil spill. It's great news that BP and this Coast Guard have agreed to take steps to rescue turtles and prevent them from burning," unquote. The agreement came moments before the start of a legal hearing sought by conservation groups to resolve the threats to turtles posed by intentionally set fires intended to burn off spilled oil in the Gulf. BP and the Coast Guard agreed to develop a protocol ensuring no endangered sea turtles will be killed during burn containment practices. Conservation groups also want more assurances that qualified scientists and observers will be present at every burn to ensure that all turtles would be identified and removed before burns take place. Part of the true cost of oil is that the hyperbole uttered by the politicians who support the drill baby drill worldview also confuse the issue of what this country and this society can really afford, and this creates division within our society and among well-meaning Americans. Well, what do I mean by this? Here is a brief clip that will help us understand how politicians and people that we call our leaders are at the moment saying drill baby drill. They are in cahoots with the oil and gas lobby. So I'm going to play this brief clip, drill baby drill, and I will have my voiceover to identify each speaker and to what financial extent he or she benefits from supporting the oil and gas lobby.
Drill baby drill.
We ought to be drilling.
It is safe to drill.
Drill baby drill and drill now.
Drill baby drill.
Drill baby
drill.
Drill baby drill. Drill, drill, drill.
For offshore exploration and drilling, it's environmentally safe and economically smart.
I think the environmental impact of this disaster is likely to have been very, very modest.
That's the CEO of British Petroleum, and BP spent $16 million lobbying Congress in 2009.
Drill here, drill now, because I want you to pay less.
The oil and gas lobby spent $174 million lobbying in 2009.
The risks associated with offshore oil and gas drilling are far outweighed by the benefits.
That's Senator Landrieu of Louisiana, who took $363,950 from the oil and gas lobby.
We need to be drilling off our coast for oil and gas.
Governor Jindal of Louisiana took more than $200,000 from the oil and gas lobby.
Tar balls are no big deal.
Tar balls are no big deal. Governor Barbour of Mississippi took $1.8 million from the oil and gas lobby.
Drill, baby, drill!
Rudolph Giuliani, he took $608,358 from the oil and gas lobby.
Drill here, drill now, let's use our own resources.
Senator Vitter of Louisiana took $385,500 from the oil and gas lobby.
It is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown.
It's a $20 billion shakedown. Representative Joe Barton of Texas, who took $1,448,380 from the oil and gas lobby.
I don't think that you can forget the jobs that have sustained many, many families across this country, and that's in our more traditional fossil fuels.
Senator Murkowski of Alaska took $426,989 from the oil and gas lobby.
It's something that no one can put their finger on, and it may be an accident, it may be something else.
No one can put your finger on, Governor Perry of Texas. All in all, Texas politicians took $16.7 million from the oil and gas lobby.
Drill offshore and drill now.
That's drill baby drill. John McCain, along with Sarah Palin, he took $2.4 million from the oil and gas lobby for their 2008 presidential campaign.
Among the fishermen here in southern Louisiana, there is deep frustration since the spill closed down their livelihoods.
Now, that's a video from the group Power Without Petroleum, and they have a Facebook link where you can lobby yourself to end these gifts that are bribes and everything but public name. They are not publicly called bribes. They are called lobbying. So go to the website Raising Sand Radio for that link.
Woo!
It's Jefferson Airplane with Volunteers and Start a Revolution. It's really difficult to get honest numbers about the oil and gas industry or the oil and gas lobby, as there are so many different ways to spin these numbers, so many ways to calculate, so many things our government and the corporations that control them don't want us to know. But the numbers are out there, and taking a little time to seek them out turns up real bonanzas. The Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, and I'll put a link to that site on the website Raising Sand Radio and the blog for you to read the entire document. In the meantime, it's iags.org. So the Institute for Analysis of Global Security states that the cost of the 1990-91 Gulf War, the result of an oil dispute between Iraq and Kuwait, cost the international community almost $80 billion. The cost of the 2004 Iraq War and occupation is estimated at a lowball figure to date of $200 billion, and we know it's much greater than that. Now, keep in mind that the Department of Energy estimates that each $1 billion of trade deficit costs America 27,000 jobs. According to the National Defense Council Foundation, the economic penalties of America's oil dependence total $297.2 to $305 billion annually. If reflected at the gas pump, these hidden costs would raise the price of a gallon of gasoline to over $5.28. This means filling up an average tank would cost over $100. To ensure access to the oil that fuels our economy, the United States is forced to maintain a continuous presence in the Middle East. This presence has been a rallying cry for anti-Americanism and Islamic fundamentalism. The Institute for Analysis of Global Security suggests that the September 11th attacks were motivated by Al-Qaeda's desire to drive the quote-unquote infidel armies out of the oil-rich Persian Gulf. World competition for dwindling oil reserves will force the U.S. to increase its footprints in these conflicted regions, while oil-generated wealth would continue to provide extremists the capital to market and implement the ideas worldwide. The unavoidable result will be even more terrorism and instability. According to the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, the energy security and national security concerns that stem from reliance on a single energy source that is unevenly distributed throughout the world will be intensified as demand for oil grows. Among the results of this is the reality that the U.S. will need to keep increasing American military presence in the region to ensure our access to remaining oil. This will mean further U.S. embroilment in Middle East conflicts, more anti-American sentiment, and a deepening rift between the West and the Islamic world. We're already seeing a pretty deep rift, so imagine it getting worse. It also means a tension between the United States and China due to Chinese intervention in the Middle East to ensure its own access to oil, and the Chinese arming of Middle Eastern countries hostile to the United States and its allies. And it will mean a further drain on economic resources caused by imports of expensive oil. So when it comes down to the question of whether we can actually afford to shift away from our petroleum-based energy system, one should remember that the combined impact of wars, terrorism, and environmental degradation and social disruption, as is happening in the Gulf right now, is likely to send the price of oil through the ceiling over the next two decades. Alternatively, the cost of emerging technologies is likely to decrease over time as mass production and commercialization takes place. The Institute for the Analysis of Global Security suggests that if history is our guide, we can see that every industrial and technological revolution in history inspired an economic boom. So building an infrastructure for next-generation industries would actually generate millions of jobs around the world and revolutionize the automobile industry as well as these other industries. Researching, developing, and introducing new transportation technologies that are cleaner, safer, and less economically destructive should be a top national security and economic priority. Again, I have a link to the Power Without Petroleum video on the website, on the RaisingSand.org website, where you can urge policymakers to take a broader, more nuanced, and more complex view of our mutual futures. And that is our show for today. Again, visit RaisingSandRadio.org, where we archive all our shows for anyone to download. Or visit MotherSpeak.org. Raising Sand Radio is a project of MotherSpeak, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. You can also purchase a CD of any of our shows there, too. And please consider making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio or to MotherSpeak at either of those websites, RaisingSandRadio.org or MotherSpeak.org, where you can also learn more about our new project we call This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. This project examines and shares the first-person stories of Indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the United States, Palestine, and South Africa. We use the lens of industrialization and focus on what is happening to these people and environments, and we ask what can be learned from them that can inform more sustainable ways of living and making a living. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the project too. Bring your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us. You're also invited to share your own story if you have a story that of how the land you grew up on has been changed. Get in touch with me directly at Susan at Raising Sand Radio. And we go out again with James McMurdy and We Can't Make It Here Anymore.
Sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't to say, the regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards, some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. Hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they've never known need. The ship don't stink and the kids won't bleed. The kids won't bleed in the damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. In the alley and trash in the street, gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.